This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Late Night Woman's Hour. This month, we're going travelling. Imagine yourself streaming through time, shedding gloves, umbrellas, wrenches, books, friends, homes, names. This is what the world looks like if you take a rear-facing seat on a train. Looking forward, you constantly acquire moments of arrival, moments of realisation, moments of discovery. The wind blows your hair back and you are greeted by what you have never seen before. So writes Rebecca Solnit in her book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost. Women have always dreamed of escaping their ordinary lives, but it's only in recent history that travel has become a legitimate opportunity to do so, and then only for some. The journeys of female adventurers like Cheryl Strayed and Robin Davidson capture the public imagination. We'll be discussing this month the pleasures and pitfalls of wanderlust with some very well-travelled women. Lois Price has travelled the world alone on her motorbike. Named one of the greatest female travellers by the Daily Telegraph, she's written a number of books about her life as, her word, an adventuress. Welcome.
Hello.
Rana Rahimpour grew up in Iran and had to seek her parents' permission as a young female student to go travelling in her own country. Now based in London, she presents on the BBC's Persian TV network. Her decision to move here means she cannot return to Iran, even to visit, because under the present regime, BBC employees face arrest. She has also written about being stopped from travelling to the US by Donald Trump's travel ban. Welcome, Rana.
Hello.
Carolyn Pearson is the founder of women's travel network Maiden Voyage. It seeks to make life easier for women travelling alone and was inspired by her own experiences. Hello, Carolyn.
Hello.
And Victoria Adegensho, who was born in Manchester but is now based in Berlin. A passionate advocate of travelling with a family and on a budget, her motto is, if I can do it, so can you. Hello, Victoria.
Hello.
And with that in mind, if I can do it, so can you. Let's get going. So why do we travel? Lois, you are a self-described adventuress. When did you find that out? And what does travel bring to your life?
I don't think I've ever described myself as an adventuress, actually.
It's on your website. I've been looking.
I think early days, probably as a teenager, I always had itchy feet. And I think probably started when I was 13. I and three friends went off on a bicycle trip with no grown-ups, which is unthinkable of four 13-year-old girls all just bicycling around Cornwall. I don't think that would happen now, but we had kind of quite gung-ho parents, and it was that era, kind of 80s, that you were just allowed to roam free. And I think that was my first experience of a road trip, really, and just seeing what happened and not knowing where you're going to sleep that night when you wake up. That's the dream for me.
So and that was it. So it was the kind of the unknown that hooked you.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Rana, I mean, having grown up in a culture where women travelling alone was very much not the norm, what did experiencing travel bring you?
Well, my upbringing was very different from Lewis's. There, even when I was in my 20s, I wasn't allowed to leave home and travel with my girlfriends. I did, but I had to lie. I had to pretend that I was traveling with university and with teachers and professors. And I had to lie to an extent that sometimes my father gave me a lift to the university. And then he thought I was going with them. And then as soon as he left, I had to get a cab and join my friends at the airport and fly.
Fly,
so, yes. And then when I was, I don't know, by the sea in the north of Iran, my father phoned and said, oh, where are you? I said, oh, we're having fun in Kashan, which is a different city that he thought I was in. And looking back, I think it wasn't very wise. What if, I mean, with the number of airplanes that are crashing in Iran, I thought it wasn't very wise, but I had fun.
To be in a completely different city.
And exactly.
What was it that kind of persuaded you to take those risks? And
because you're young and you just want to get out there and have fun with your friends and see new places and just can't stay where your parents want you to stay. So I just couldn't stop myself.
And what and you know that never left you, that desire to kind
that
of
never
experience
left
new
me
things.
Although because I have children, I can't be that adventurous, not as adventurous as I wish to be.
No, do you know, we might come to that with Victoria.
Yeah, she'll set you right. Quite right.
Yes, exactly. She's going to get you tall. Victoria, I mean, travel blogs and stories are very popular, but not all of them are as pragmatic and as realistic as yours is. There's, you know, out there in the market, there's quite a lot of kind of aspirational clifftop yoga, which is not your vibe.
Not really, no.
Clifftop yoga is not your thing. I mean, do you feel different to the other bloggers out there? Is that why you started writing?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm not 20. You know, I don't aspire to be 20. I'm married now. I'm a professional. I'm a corporate person, which means I travel during the holidays. I travel over the weekends. Sometimes I go with my son. Sometimes I go with my husband. Sometimes I go alone. Sometimes we go together. Sort of a mix and blend type of thing.
Okay. And how many countries have you been to, say, in the past year? Because your list is impressive. I was looking at the blog and I kind of lost count quite quickly.
I think about 7 now.
Okay. So yeah. That's not bad in 6 months. Yeah. With a full-time job and, as you say, yeah, family and stuff.
Yes.
Carolyn, what about maiden voyage? Why did you start it and how does it work?
Well, I'm just a sociable animal, and it was actually, I don't know if you remember the website that used to be World's Best Bars, and I found myself in LA and I was trolling through World's Best Bars thinking, I can't go to any of these places by myself because I'll just look like a complete Billy No Mates on a Saturday night sat there
and so, hanging out at an amazing bar, yeah, with no,
yeah,
friends.
And then on, so I was stuck in a hotel in LA, in downtown LA, it wasn't in Hollywood, and when my colleagues came on the Monday, I was absolutely climbing up the walls, and we went to the Sky Bar at the Mondrian Hotel in West Hollywood, and I thought, this is where I should have been on Saturday night. And I'd had a few drinks, and so I said, I'm going to create a social network for female business travellers. And then the guys kind of egged me on, and then I had to do it.
And how quickly did it take off? And how soon did you find out that there were other women like you out there?
It was a fluke. So within a few weeks of me creating the website, Management Today magazine said, can we write about you? And so I got all my friends to sign up and make it look like a real thing. And then the New York Times said, could we do a feature? And they did a feature. And then before I knew it, I was actually working for ITV at the time, and CNN called me in and said, can we do a piece on you? And I've always been behind camera doing IT, not in front of a camera. And they just pointed this camera at me and got this guy from Wired magazine to talk about niche social networks. And then before I knew it, I got women from countries that I'd never even heard of signing up.
Oh, fantastic. Brilliant. So, I mean, Lois, tell me a little bit about traveling alone, because a lot of the stories, you know, I've already mentioned Cheryl Strayed and Wild. And I suppose the thing that captured people's imagination about that was in part that she did it on her own and, you know, barefoot. I think it starts with her kind of throwing her boots away.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, does traveling alone make a difference?
I think for me, it does. And I don't feel so strongly about doing it now, but for my first big trip, which was 2003, I sort of packed in the job with no clue what would happen next and rode my motorcycle from Alaska to the bottom of South America. And it was really important that I did that alone. And actually, I just met the man that would become my husband just before I left. And I was like, I've still got to go. And he was very much, no, you got to go and do this on your own. He really understood. 10 months. Yeah. So for me, it presents more of a challenge. But what appealed to me was the idea of sort of living on my wits, sort of not quite knowing what was going to happen, having to sort everything out by myself. I mean, a bit older now, and that just makes us feel tired. But I was, you know, 29, 30. I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to throw myself out in the world and just see what happens. And I want to be able to fix all those problems and sort of wangle my way across borders and, you know, mend broken bits of my bike and you know.
And did you know that
that was the fun?
Did you know that you had those skills, or was that, you know, you were kind of crossing your fingers a little bit?
What was
what was the motivation was kind of finding out if I did have them. I sort of had a hunch that I might have them, and I did obviously some preparation and you know, sort of trying to work out how my bike worked a little bit. But really, I didn't have much of a clue about anything. But for me, that naivety was actually part of the pleasure.
I mean, Rana, what about travelling alone and perhaps, you know, in your work as a journalist? You know, that's very much, again, when people tell stories, part of the reason that the stories that connect with people are stories of, you know, as Lois has described, people who are by themselves out in the field, getting the story, talking their way out of a kind of sticky situation and making what they need to happen.
Yeah, so travelling in Iran is have different aspects. So travelling in Iran as an Iranian woman is a very different experience from travelling as a non-Iranian woman, which Louise has experienced. When you travel inside the country as an Iranian, most men think that you belong to them. So suddenly they think that they have to protect you. They think that you are in danger. They think that you are not allowed to stay at a hotel on your own. So it's a very different experience for an Iranian woman. And I can't say that it's the safest experience, because when you're on your own, alone, without a man, without a husband, without your father, they think that you're accessible. You are a loose woman. So it's not something that I would enjoy doing. And whenever I travelled, I made sure that I travelled within a group of friends. I was never on my own.
And being a reporter and in that situation, does that magnify those risks and those problems?
Not really, because even as a reporter, you're always with a producer and a cameraman. And in most of those jobs, especially in Iran, are done by men. So you can your really cameraman is always a man. So you rarely have a camera woman with you. So.
Very often the case over here, to be fair.
Yes.
So I mean, are you saying that really, you know, you really weren't often alone? You know, it wasn't possible.
It's not impossible, but it's uncomfortable.
Okay.
Getting accommodation for a single Iranian woman is not very easy. So hotels are not very keen. You have to find a private place who's happy to let you stay in a room. But generally, it's not something very common, as Louise says. Would confirm it's very unusual to see a woman traveling alone in Iran. And if you do, you, as an Iranian inside Iran, you might not feel very comfortable about it.
Lois, I mean, you know, what are you kind of thinking listening
well,
to?
Well, it is very different, I think, being an Iranian woman traveling in Iran. And a lot of Iranian women would tell me that they would be more likely to be harassed than I would, because I was seen as a visitor and people felt they needed to show that Iran was a good place and they wanted me to have a good time. But I mean, I had a wonderful time in Iran. I was totally on my own, riding my motorbike around, and I received so much incredible kindness and hospitality from men and women of all ages and backgrounds. It was just staggering. I loved it in Iran. The problems came, as ever, when you have the run-ins with authority. So it's men in uniform that pretty much cause all the problems anywhere in the world, really. So that was my main sticking point. I had some tricky moments with the Revolutionary Guard. And
what happened?
They drove their car into my bike, and I don't know what if I'm allowed to say naughty words on this programme, but it all kicked off. And everyone understands certain words, no matter where they are in the world. And it probably wasn't the most diplomatic moment of my life. But anyway, it's a long story, which is probably not enough time to go into now. But I was genuinely scared. It was quite hairy because obviously, you know, the power that they have in Iran. So, and I felt quite vulnerable, obviously, as a woman on my own, you know, a foreign woman riding a motorcycle, which is essentially a man's transport in Iran, because women are forbidden from riding bikes in Iran in public. So I was like the circus had come to town, because everywhere I went, I was a novelty. So that was slightly overwhelming sometimes. But the curiosity was always well-meaning from the regular people. They just wanted to feed me. I mean, I put on so much weight just stuffing food into my pantry.
It's going to have to be a bicycle next time just to keep it off.
Yeah. It was amazing.
I mean, I wonder if you guys have heard about Viaco Sola, which is the hashtag of women responding to press coverage of the murders of young women who have travelled alone and you know, obviously had terrible experiences and you know, been damaged. And the press coverage, which can be quite judgmental. I mean, Victoria, are you familiar with that hashtag
well,
and
I'm
the stories?
Familiar with
that hashtag, but I do know the stories. The very first time that I actually started traveling was when I was an undergraduate. And my very first job was actually in Eastern Europe. I had absolutely no idea what I was going to be doing there. And it was pretty much on the spot. I was sort of given an opportunity to go over to Eastern Europe. And I asked, when would you like me to go? And they said, tomorrow. I didn't know the language. I didn't know what I was doing. I'd never been to the country before. I was going to see someone who I'd met twice. All this particular person gave me was a sheet of paper and a company credit card. That was it. And then we shook hands and then he left. And I was there having to do this project, which didn't exist, having to work with people who weren't there. And I ended up going to the university, knocking on people's doors and asking, excuse me, do you speak English? Excuse me, do you speak English? And then I sort of created a group, and that's how I started. But that was the beginning of having that feeling that I could do much more than I could ever do. I'm the only girl in my family. I'm from a family of three brothers. I was never allowed to do a single thing. I'd never worked at all. I'd never traveled alone. I'd never lived alone. I was scared to death. But it worked marvellously.
And it is, you know, it's interesting that you both seem to be describing a kind of mix of excitement and fear,
and
you know,
fear,
that
yes.
That could kind of not work out,
yeah.
and things could be difficult. I mean, Carolyn, how do you think that the travel industry is starting to respond to, you know, women travelling alone and wanting to do that, but perhaps wanting to, you know, feel that they're going to be safe?
Well, I travelled alone when I was 25, and, you know, I think sometimes a near-death experience is quite, what's the word, enriching. When you're still alive at the end of it and you feel really exhilarated because you've been through something really scary, that's when I think you really, really feel alive. You know, I've been dumped in the desert. I've been harnessed to a yacht that was, you know, stuck out in the ocean and, you know...
You've been harnessed to a yacht and you've been dumped in the desert. Are these real examples?
Real examples, yeah. I was abandoned in the desert in the middle of Australia in December when it was like 150 degrees.
Were you on a stag do? What happened?
No. I was travelling with a family and... The wife and the husband fell out and it was all female solidarity. So I got out of the car with her and he drove off and left us.
Oh, man.
And we had to hitchhike into Alice Springs with some guy who had a gun and a cattle dog, and he kept pulling off into the bush every 10 minutes and we thought he was going to kill us, but he had to keep putting oil into the car. So actually... more women are travelling, and the industry, of course, understands the value of the female pound. But I don't think we should, you know, over-egg the taking
risks.
Away the excitement that you have as well.
Yeah, I agree.
I think there's
always a focus on... Whenever women get together to talk about travel, because I take part in various events of this kind, and it always goes straight into the safety and the fear. And you know that there's a, you know, at the same event, there's probably a group of guys talking about all the exciting things that they're going to do. And I always think, why can't we focus on that? Because I know from my own experiences, the world isn't as scary as one might think it is if you just read the news and, you know. People are really friendly and curious and kind and they want to help you. And I think a genuine human response to seeing a woman alone in a foreign country is, I hope she's okay and I want to make sure she's all right. I really believe that and I've experienced that all over the world.
I'm sure. I mean, but, you know, perhaps it is equivalent to a lightning strike. But, of course, bad things do happen.
And you hear much more about them than you do about the positive experiences.
Yeah, we created a business around that. I mean, I lecture all day long about travel safety and I talk about, you know, kidnap and horrendous things that happen. But actually, if you've
unusual.
Got a plan B and a plan C, yeah. Then you know what to do if something goes wrong. It's when you arrive in a place and your car doesn't turn up and then you've not thought about what you might do in that situation. But if you prepare, then you can... immerse and enjoy the environment.
I think it's also the case, isn't it, that if a young woman is travelling alone and, God forbid, something awful happens to her, you know, the way that is reported
Absolutely.
Is often... It's
yeah.
often, you know, done in this kind of victim-blaming
like
way.
Judgmental kind of
yeah.
way, yeah, exactly.
Well, like the girls who were raped and murdered in Latin America, it was, why were they travelling by themselves?
Crazy.
If it was two guys, they would never say that, would they?
I mean, it's often the case, isn't it, that if a young woman is travelling alone and something does happen
to her that the subsequent reporting is tends to be quite victim blaming. I mean, sometimes outright the kinds of questions that are asked. I mean, Rana, what do you think of that? You know, these stories do come up, but they're not treated equally. I think if it was a young man, different questions would be asked. Why are they travelling alone?
Isn't that because the hazards are different? Because the possibility of a rape for a woman in an unknown environment is much higher than a man. That's why we tend to think that women are more vulnerable in those situations. And if a man gets killed while he's travelling alone, it's probably a fight. And then there is cultural sensitivities as well. So we hear about women in India who are getting raped. We hear that in Egypt they're getting groped while they're just walking down the streets. So I think because culturally there are still so many countries that perceive women as vulnerable, fragile creatures that they are allowed to treat badly. That's why I think there is more sensitivity about women travelling alone.
Mm. Absolutely, and there's legal restrictions and cultural restrictions. Then when you overlay religion on top as well. Mm. The world isn't equal, unfortunately, is it?
No, it's not. I think the form of transport that you use can make a big difference. And I noticed this by travelling by motorcycle. You kind of elevated almost to male status in more traditional cultures. And the guys will come up and they won't harass you or chat you up or give you a wink and a pinch on the bum. They'll say, oh, what size engine is your bike? Or, you know, and then you're straight onto a different level.
Yeah, the level of conversation is different.
Yes. And I remember in Peru, that was very very much the case. I got off the bike, sort of changed into my sundress and flip-flops and potted around the town square. And then it was all, you know, back to the cat calls and I was like, well, I'm sticking with the leathers and the oily fingernails, you know, because it really transforms it, how people respond to you. Women tend to like it as well. You know, you'll get sort of old ladies in Iran kind of hugging me in the street and saying, oh, well done. And, you know,
many of them can only dream about
exactly,
what they've done.
Yeah.
There's an Iranian woman who travels on her own all over the world, and her Instagram page has about 80,000 followers. And when you read people's responses to her posts, they always say that, I wish I could be you.
Absolutely.
My only dream is being able to do what you're doing.
Yeah. Mm.
That's why they're so welcoming to a woman who's there on her own, because that's why they aspire.
Rana, I think you've had family members from Iran come and visit you here, and I wonder for the female members of your family what that experience was like and what you saw happen from their perspective.
Yeah, that's also quite an adventure, because unfortunately the Iranians can't travel easily to most countries on Earth, so we can only go to Turkey and Syria, and who wants to go to Syria for holidays these days? So it's very difficult to travel to Europe or to the United States. When I moved here, I sent an invitation letter to my uncle and my aunt, and she's an elderly lady in her 70s and quite religious. She wore the headscarf, and for them, coming to London was the most adventurous thing they'd ever done in their life. And it was so cute to watch them, because when they arrived, the first thing on our way from the airport to my flat was that, wow, look at how different the cars are, because most of the car manufacturers in Iran are owned by the government, so there are only four or five types of cars there. And then she said, women are so modest here.
And they don't wear that much makeup.
How come they don't wear that much makeup? Because, look, I'm sure you've noticed that in Iran, because
amazing,
women are forced to cover their hair, they concentrate too much on their faces. So they look like Japanese dolls because they wear so much makeup. And then later on, they came back for my wedding, and she looked at the dress and said, but that's not revealing. How come women are so modest here? And the bit with that, which was very sweet, is that after a few weeks, she went and she bought a smaller, shorter coat, because she felt that she didn't have to cover up that much. And then for the wedding, she said, actually, I thought maybe I won't wear my headscarf, but I'll wear a wig. And we thought, a wig? Well, what's wrong with a wig? And then they went and they bought a wig, which suited a 20-year-old, not a 70-year-old.
I'm all for that. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to put my foot down. Absolutely.
So she... she was transforming, and she became less religious. They only came here twice, but she's now a completely transformed woman. And it makes me sad that not many Iranian people, especially women, are not able to travel more and to realize that the world is not the way the Iranian media inside the country are wanting them to think it is.
I mean, to what extent is travel wrapped up with privilege, do you think, Victoria? I mean, you've written about financial privilege a lot too, and obviously, you know, your site has a lot of kind of tips and explanation about how you travel as much as you do and often on a budget.
Right, exactly. I mean,
can you give us some take-home information
for the
itchy-footed listener?
basically, save. You know, save as much as you can. Rather than taking the plane, you can take the train. Rather than taking the train, you can take the bus. Rather than taking the bus, get yourself a £100 car, take about 4 or 5 people, bungle everybody in, take a tent, and then just go. Basically, there's loads of places. There's Airbnb, there's couch surfing, there's camping. You don't really have to have $1 million to go outside at all.
And what about destinations? Because I know you have this, you know, this kind of phrase that you use over and over again. Just go, just do it. And it's not always about kind of having the, I don't know, aspirational place that everybody, the bucket list list of places ticked off a list. It's about kind of where can you get to?
Absolutely.
And just kind of going and experiencing that.
I mean, what I say is you don't have to go to exotic places. You don't have to go across the waters. If you're in Britain, going to Yorkshire, if you live in London, is like going to another planet, you know. So just go to the next city and
in
you're
a really good way, just to check.
Yes.
Yeah, in a massive way.
I'm an orphaner, so, you know.
Exactly. Well, me too.
Going to another town, going to another part of your country is just as good and just as valid as going to the other side of the world. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what travel is. There's a lot of discussion about how people travel. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, as long as you're moving, that's travel.
I mean, what do you think, Carolyn, about this idea of just kind of sticking a pin in a map or, you know, just getting where you can get to and then experiencing it wherever
it is? Oh, absolutely. I spent a year traveling around Australia. And I met this guy, as you do, and he was actually called Bruce. And we decided to go to Cape York, which is a northern.
This isn't the one that left you in the desert.
No,
in the
bottom. No. He's the one that got me out of the desert, actually.
Good old
Hence
Bruce.
Hence why I felt obliged to spend a bit of time with him. But we decided to go to Cape York, which is the northernmost point of Australia. And so you drive through, you know, ravines, and you can swim with saltwater crocodiles, and you go through Aboriginal camps, and oh my God, it was magical. But when I went to Australia, I didn't plan to do that. Didn't even know that that existed. I absolutely love the idea of not knowing where you're going to end up, and I would have done the same. Yeah.
Lois, what about you? I mean, how many of your adventures are planned, and how much room for spontaneity do you leave?
It's tricky because doing a sort of transcontinental trip, you have to get your visas organised. But I'll have a starting point and a finishing point. So I did, like I said, Alaska to Tierra del Fuego, and then London to Cape Town. And so I know when I'm leaving, I know where I'm trying to get to, but what happens in between is always up for grabs. I mean, I'll get my visas as much as I can, but sometimes you have to kind of wangle them as you go. And that's part of the fun. And I love the flexibility of just thinking, oh, I wonder what's down that track, or oh, I'll stay here for a bit longer, or I'll pop into a neighbouring country. And, you know, so that is, to me, the essence of adventure.
And what about getting lost? I mean, you know, the idea.
Oh, you've got to relish it. Yeah, because it gives you a panic to start with. But I'm very kind of low-fi. I don't use any gadgets or GPS sat nav. I only use paper maps. In Iran, that was absolutely disastrous. The terrible maps. Some of them were pre-revolutionary. You know, all the street names were wrong. But that means that you have to ask people directions, and that's when all the fun stuff happens. Because some guy will say,
"Especially if they don't speak English."
Yeah, exactly. You know, they're pointing this way and that. Oh, they say, "I'll show you," and then it's like, well. come back to my, you know, mum's house or come to a party. And
sometimes
I think
they don't know, but they still try to help and they send you to the
wrong
place.
Exactly, yeah. But, you know, there's that saying, the interruptions of the journey. And that, I think, is that's when it gets interesting. Well, as if you're just sort of following a tiny little screen in front of you, you know you'll get to where you want to go, but it's probably nothing fun will happen along the way. So.
And what's the trip that changed you the most? Because presumably, you know, the joy of this as well is that you come back a little bit different. I mean, Victoria and Rana, you've both made your homes in different countries than the ones that you were born in. Tell me a little bit about the decision to settle rather than to keep passing through.
Well, to me, it was already a decision made. I knew that going back home would be difficult. So when I sat down with my parents and they said, if you want to take this job, know that you cannot come back until this regime is in power. But I was 25 and I just wanted to go away. And I was looking for an adventure. And being the first woman in my entire family to leave the country on my own, going and exploring the unknown. So I accepted it. Although at the time, many of my uncles and aunts were telling my parents that you shouldn't let her do this. This is crazy. But my parents, luckily, are more open-minded than their siblings. So I said, no, this is your life. You can do it. But I remember that when I arrived here at BBC accommodation in Bayswater, I was given a single bedroom. And my view was a courtyard with bars behind the window. And I asked for the loo, and it was a shared loo. And I was such a pampered, only girl of the family. And I hadn't slept for 48 hours, and I had cried a lot and said goodbye to friends and family for forever. And I sat in that room, and I pulled the curtain, and I was looking at the courtyard, and I had to share a loo with other people who were staying in the accommodation. And I started crying, and I said, what have I done? What have I done? I have left my comfortable life behind and I can't go back. And this is it. And I was too proud to phone my parents and said, please, I want to come back.
Mm-hmm. Or everybody will have to move over here. How are we going to work this out? I mean, and you know, how long did it take for you to overcome that? And how do you feel about it now? Because, you know, you mentioned earlier that you're a parent now and, you know, that gives you a kind of... That gives you a particular kind of long view, I think.
Surprisingly, like Victoria, when I, a few months later, I went to Cannes for the film festival to cover it for the Persian service. And I had a great time and I was partying with friends who came over from Iran. And I loved it. But the moment I got to the Heathrow airport, I suddenly felt at home. Yeah. And I felt at ease. I loved the fact that people were queuing and were so polite. And they were so polite and they were so kind.
It was raining. It wasn't like Cannes. It wasn't all warm and beachy. It was drizzly. It smelled of chips.
Wow, okay, I now feel at home. And that's the moment I realised that this is where I'm going to be. And then a few months later, because there was a presidential election in Iran that turned sour and the relations between the BBC and the Iranian government were totally cut off. And that was the moment I realised I couldn't go back. Mm. At the beginning, it was difficult. Then I decided that, okay, that was the first chapter of my life, first 25 years, and that's it. My home is here and I can't look back and I constantly be sad about my past. The past is past.
Yeah. And coming home is coming home.
Coming home is coming home.
Okay. I mean, to what extent is being a traveller a part of your identity? Tell me a little bit about that, Carolyn.
God, I only feel normal when I'm in an airport. I really do. I just get this little buzz and then I get all excited. Even if I'm just going on a business trip to Paris or something, I just feel at home when I'm travelling. And when I get home, I can get a bit depressed. But actually, it's proven, isn't it, that travel, when you have new experiences, your brain releases dopamine. So it is actually addictive. It is a drug that you can be addicted to. And I think it's a lot better than some drugs, right?
Absolutely. And where to next, then, with that in mind?
So top of my bucket list is Tahiti. You just have to say, just do it, or just go, or something.
Just go.
So Tahiti's really on my list. I am the clifftop yoga woman, so I did do that in Sri Lanka last year.
There's a lot of clifftop yoga about. I think it's time for you not to.
I am. And then, I mean, the good thing about my job is that I get to work all around the world. So I've just come back from Silicon Valley. But even there, I can make my home within an hour of arriving. I found the juice bar, the Korean spa, Equinox gym, you know.
You just go to the airport and you feel at home.
Yeah. Actually, I got stuck on a train the other week. I was delayed for 9 hours and I convinced my fellow passengers that I actually lived on the East Coast main line.
Believe me.
There's been months in my life when I felt like I do. And Lois, I mean, presumably not an amble through duty free doesn't exactly signify home to you.
Oh, I love those big bottles of gin.
Where are you going
I'm
next?
I'm kind of torn between, I love home. I'm not one of these sort of people that wants to be on the road for years at a time. And I'm quite, you know, quite homely. I'm in a band in London. I like gardening, you know, I'm growing tomatoes. So I always sort of slightly torn in that, you know, I'm always itchy and kind of wanting to hit the road and see somewhere. And I've got, you know, all the countries I want to visit. But I definitely need my time at home as well. And I think being at home for a while, it kind of, you need to get bored. You need to get that itch to get out there again. But you know, my work, I do lots of sort of events and writing and stuff. So I'm always on the road somewhere, really. And so sometimes I'm thinking, you know, God, I wouldn't mind just a couple of days at home and, you know, a bit of deadheading in the garden. Practice a banjo, you know.
Two nights in the same bed.
So, exactly. You know, so, I've got quite a good balance of it, really. But with my big, you know, I've done these sort of 3 long distance motorcycle trips. They've been quite a few years apart. It's not like I'm not sort of endlessly roaming around on the bike, you know.
So for now, you've arrived.
Yeah, because I've just been in Iran a lot recently and I'm at home at the moment and sort of enjoying that. So,
well, that sounds perfect. That's all we've got time for tonight. Thank you very much indeed to my guests, Lois Price, Rana Rahimpur, Carolyn Pearson and Victoria Adegencio.